Session number 20596, Reel 8.
Mr. Somerset, Reel 8.
The resident was very keen to settle a big land dispute between my people, the Agonis, the Alemi clan, and some people called the Akrikas. And he's a very experienced officer, and he probably knew better than I did that I was going to have more trouble than I had anticipated. I mean, when I received the assistance of this half unit of 50 men, I didn't immediately send them back again saying I didn't want them. No, I did keep them when I got them. But I didn't actually send for them. They were sent to me. I think my resident was right. But normally, one just didn't have these sort of... One didn't have these problems. I mean, law and order very largely kept itself. Which didn't mean that the people weren't vastly litigious. The native courts were cheap, very popular, and as my first DO said, he said after all, he said, you haven't got any cinema in this part of the world. If you want a bit of entertainment, you go to the native court. What's going on there? And I think compared with the courts in this country, pretty quick. That's just not a very fair comparison, but you know, cases in this country seem to me to take years. Well, in Nigeria, they took weeks or months. And the courts were, I suppose, are perhaps the foundation of our authority. Because in a slow-moving or almost stagnant society, it's the chap who dishes out the judgments who's really on top. I mean, there isn't a lot of administrative activity. If you think back in the sort of Middle Ages, or the Arabic has it very, very clearly. I mean, in Arabia, you've got a hakim who's a judge. He dishes out hukums, which are judgments. He sits in a mahkama, a court, but the government is called the hakuma, the thing sort of in charge of all these judgments. And it's only in sort of modern times that governments have been expected to actually initiate things. In the old days, it just sort of presided over the judges. Well, that's the situation we're in. And we could intervene in the native courts either of our own motion, because we didn't like a judgment, or more often we were asked to review at the request of one of the parties. They could also appeal against the judgment of the native court. The difference between a review and appeal was in the case of a review, the party requesting a review didn't have to say what was wrong with the judgment. They said, will the DO please look at it? If they were put the case on appeal, which was slightly more expensive, they had to produce grounds of appeal as to why the judgment was unsatisfactory. The other difference was that the case could go by on review or appeal to the resident, but it could also go on appeal through the chief commissioner or lieutenant governor or governor, depending on what his title was, on if there was some point of law. Now, you might say, what law were you administering? Well, the native court's ordinance said something like this: native law and custom shall be observed insofar as it is compatible with natural humanity and justice, which left us a very, very wide sort of scope for interpretation. Now, things I found about Africa as compared with Arabia was that native law and custom was understandable and defensible in that there was a balance between rights and duties. And if I might give one example, but two sides of it. In my first tour, one of the jobs I was given was to be the sort of chairman of the local Nigerian Ex-Servicemen's Welfare Association, NAWA. It was tended to get a bit sort of political and so on. But the particular case I remember was that of a girl whose father had died, more likely than killed, on active service. Would NAWA pay for her education? And, or I suppose, maybe sort of secondary education. There weren't many girls getting secondary education in those days. And I said, well, just wait a moment. When this girl marries, who is going to chop the bride price? You know what I mean by bride price?
Yes.
And they said, oh, our uncle, of course.
Chop it?
Well, when I, there's a Nigerian expression, who's going to receive it? You know, Gordon Brown chops our tax, doesn't he? That's how an African will put it.
He does.
You know, he chop them too much, master. Mm-hmm. Well, he's chopping too. Well, the uncle would chop the bride price, you see. So I said, well, in that case, the uncle's the man to pay for her education. Because I said, otherwise, when this girl marries, the person to chop the bride price is this organisation, NAWA. And they said, they shut up. They said, the ADO is right. She's quite right. We shouldn't be paying. Now, I was right there. Now, in my second trial, I had a case down in NAWI where I was wrong. A wealthy woman trader who was childless married, in inverted commas, a young girl by paying the bride price to her father. She then, as it were, farmed out the girl to some young fellow, and the girl had a child which the trading mammy claimed to be hers on the grounds that she had paid for the girl. She had married the girl. Now, I didn't like this transaction at all. The case came up over the custody of the child, which the natural father, you see, was claiming custody of the child. And I awarded him the custody of the child. But all the court and my old interpreter, old Okechukwu, said, the ADO is wrong. That child, if you leave it with the mother, and who is married to the wealthy trading mammy, the child will then inherit from the wealthy trading mammy because the child is her child, you see. Whereas you send the child off with this fellow who has no business to pay. He hasn't paid. He hasn't married the girl, and this is quite out of court. Well, I see now that I was wrong, and they were right according to their own thing. But the point I'm trying to make is that responsibilities and rights did seem to be quite well balanced. It was another sign, as I say, that it was a very governable territory. The other thing I think which made it governable was the fact that insofar as we were making progress, and progress was slow because we hadn't any money, we were moving in the direction they wanted to go. Whether it was better roads and bridges, dispensaries, maternity homes, schools, that was the way they wanted to go. Now, the question, the comment made to me, or criticism, if you like, of our colonial system, made to me by a retired Indian civilian who's working on the papers in Rhodes House, said, "You do seem to have found time for pretty parish pump matters." And I said, "Well, we didn't just find time for them, it was our sole concern." As a district officer, and I can only speak for myself, I frankly give a damn what happened in the next door division, as long as they didn't bother my people. And I don't think this is an uncommon attitude. If it was anyone to bother, it was the resident. He was in charge of five or six divisions. It wasn't my affair what they did. That raid I told you about, the tax raid, that was the... actually, it was a raid from Ogoni into an area of islands called Andoni, which came between me, an arm of the Opobo, came between me and the sea. And I found these Andonis weren't paying any tax to anybody. Of course, they should have been paying tax to Opobo. They belonged to the Calabar province, they didn't belong to Rivers province. So I had no canoes. So I waited until I got low tide and moonlight, a bit like a sort of D-Day operation. And with 40 messengers, we swarmed over to one of these islands. And I think 40 messengers we had between us, we had 20 handcuffs. That was all I could raise. And with 20 handcuffs, you can actually hold 40 men, because if you handcuff them, left arm to left arm, they can't run, if you work it out. And we grabbed these fellows at night from Andoni and whipped them into the Ogoni native court for having failed to pay tax, you see, and made them pay their tax and fined them for not having paid their tax. Well, then there was naturally a complaint from the DO of Opobo that I was grabbing his tax from his men, to which I replied, "Well, if you're not going to tax them, I will," sort of, you know, because it was an offence to my people that they were paying tax and these people weren't, you see. And of course, a blast from the resident Calabar about your sort of piratical activity on the part of the Ogre. Of course, my resident in Port Harcourt, Godfrey Allen, was absolutely on my side. I think at the end of it all, we handed the tax over to the to Opobo, but of course we kept all the fines, which were probably more valuable than the tax. But as I say, otherwise, I didn't give a rap what went on in Opobo, as long as they left my people alone. We did concentrate on the trees, and we didn't see the wood. Down in Brass, looking back, I had an agricultural officer, a most splendid, dedicated chap called David Jackson, who was trying to get little rice farms going, because Brass, probably, or the Niger Delta, could be one of the great rice growing areas of the world, because you haven't got a big rise and fall of tide, probably only 3 or 4. Well, you know, actually 3 or 4 feet, probably a bit more than that. Nothing like the rise and fall of tide in this country, but I mean, it would be something under 10 feet, but quite a decent rise and fall of tide. You've got this huge river coming down, and twice a day it backs up. I mean, even at the top end of the division, Kiama, which was 80 or 100 miles up the river, you've got 4 inches of rise and fall. And of course, further down, you get several feet. Now, that, I gather, and I know agriculturalists, is what rice rather likes. It likes to be flooded out. Of course, the people weren't farmers, and it would have required a sort of social revolution to turn them into rice farmers. But I must confess, I didn't give David Jackson any support, administratively. I mean, if he asked for the loan of a launch when I wasn't using it, yes, he used to get it. But there was no sort of administrative shove behind it. The Department of Agriculture never sort of asked me to push Rice. And other officers may have been more broad-minded than I was, but I can the same sort of rather petty departmental spirit was to be found in Enugu, because I remember when I was Secretary to the Minister of Health in 1953, Nigeria got a dollop of money through the Colonial Development and Welfare Act from London, and presumably Lagos sort of, I can't remember what sort of sums of money it was sent over to the eastern region to be sort of shared out. Well, I remember thinking then, wouldn't some big scheme, little infrastructure project, have perhaps been more useful and have given a sort of more imperial flavour? I mean, supposing we'd built a bridge over the Niger between Anitra and Asaba, for instance, which is now being built, of course, or done something about the docks in Lagos, just spent all the money on that project. But what happened was that the money was divided up. I was in the health department, so we got so much money. Well, let's have a hospital here and an anti-yours program there, you know, and a leprosy settlement there. PWD got so much, agriculture got so much, and so on. And the administration got a little bit, and that would be dished out, resident here, resident there, resident there. I mean, when eventually I was down in the Goni and the same thing happened, I remember I put in a scheme to my resident in Port Harcourt and got £3,000, which, probably closer to 100,000 now, to build a bridge. Politically, I think it was a good move to spread the money out. But from the point of view of the future of Nigeria, a big project like a bridge over the Niger, or the improvement of the harbours, would have been more sensible. But many of us, I think, were like me, and we didn't think in that way. We were so busy with native courts, tax collection, little bridges, little dispensaries, little maternity homes, on that. And a complete indifference to what happened next door. We didn't think very big. The reason I labour this is because within a few years, Nigeria was going to be deluged with money from oil. And I wonder how well we would have dealt with it. I mean, if someone had said, in both Brass and Ogoni, I suppose my native authorities' budgets, in Brass I had four native authorities, if you put all their budgets together, would have amounted in the 1950s to £20,000, multiply that by 600,000 now in today's money. Ogoni, the same. Ogoni, of course, was more efficient, but one could do more with the money. Instead of being spread over 3,000 square miles, it was only being spread over 450 square miles. It was a single native authority and therefore more efficient. You didn't have the same overheads. And of course, it was all land, so one could move about very quickly and get much more done in Ogoni. Furthermore, the people were homogeneous. You didn't get sort of squabbles between different clans and so on. But if somebody had, in those days, suddenly said, "Somerset, you've got £1 million of oil money," foggiest idea what to do with it. I mean, we weren't geared to spending a lot of money because we didn't have a lot of money to spend. And we ran a tight ship. We didn't do a lot, but what we did do worked. There were very few tarred roads, but I don't ever remember them being cut. I don't remember bridges on the major roads failing. We had very few hospitals, because we only had, I know the exact figure because I was in the Ministry of Health. When I was there in 1953, we had 80 doctors, mission and government, for 8 million people. Well, why didn't you do more? Well, the population of Nigeria in the 1950s was estimated at 30 million, and the budget of the Nigerian government was 30 million. It was a pound a head to spend on, that was government. The native authorities had, well, 20,000 divided by 120, you know, the fixed rate of tax in the east, most parts of the eastern region was 12 and sixpence per taxable male. But then, of course, taxable males are probably only about a fifth of the population, because the rest are women and children or old men, you know. I mean, there wasn't a lot of money, but what the things that we did, the railways, so on, did in fact work. And when we left, Nigeria, I would have said, was governable, because it didn't need, as many of the French territories did, and I think still do, sort of subventions from outside. The country had always paid for itself. It had the government that it could afford. And of course, when all this oil money flowed in, of course, the first thing the politicians rather naturally did was to pay themselves. Then, of course, they squandered a fortune on armed forces, which Nigeria is not threatened by anybody. Nobody. Since the days of Lord Lugard and the French up at Borgu, nobody's threatened Nigeria. Doesn't need tanks and aircraft and so on. No, absolutely no need at all.
Was there, in your time, any sense of being a Nigerian as opposed to being a member of a tribe?
Well, this is a very good question. We had an unfortunate expression, which I think may have done quite a lot of harm. When people left their villages to go and work in one of the towns, we were inclined to describe them as detribalised. By that we meant that once they got in the towns, they became far less honest because all the sanctions of the village disappeared. They were dealing with people who were strangers. Even if they were Igbos, they were still strangers to the people who came from a particular, from their village. They were still strangers to them. And of course, if they were a different tribe, then they were complete strangers. We used to describe them as detribalized because they were sort of de-villagized. But of course, when they got back to their villages, all sanctions were reapplied to them. And they used to be taxed by the village for some little project, because they used to say, well, you've been abroad, you've got a lot of money, you would already subscribe to the school or the road or the dispensary or whatever it was. But of course, they weren't detribalized, they were just sort of urbanized. And this is a very difficult problem. I think it's one that an African would have great difficulty in solving. A former High Commissioner named Martin Le Cain, who was an Exeter man, I met him at Gordy's, and he said that when in his time, as he was there during Jack Gowon's time as, you know, president, and he was a friend of Jack Gowon's, and we talked to one of them, and he said, quite honestly, he said, I don't think the country is governable. It's too big. You know, 200 languages and that sort of thing. But I think it was really a tragedy, I think, that the oil money came so soon after self-government, it stoked corruption. The other thing, could we have done better? Could we have left a better system? It would have been difficult. Time was short, very short. The office of district officer is clearly not a democratic one. Though it's a bit more democratic than it seems, or at least under rural conditions it is, because you have numerous village meetings, and after all, it's all villages, you haven't got a town to deal with, and you're discussing parish pump matters. There are no other matters to discuss, and they are very thoroughly discussed, and if something can be done, you know, a cycle track opened up from here to the market, yes, we'll all turn out tomorrow and the DO will bring his prismatic compass and give us a trace and off we go. Trees come down and, you know, embankments, this is in brass and so on, arrays and so on. There's a lot of discussion, if that is what you mean by government. Which, I mean, you don't get in Parliament, do you? You just get two people going, you know. It's not discussion, just merely yaboo. And with regard to sort of rather larger issues of roads and bridges and dispensaries, maternity homes, courts and so on, I would never do anything that the or spend native authority money, which after all is their tax money, on something that they didn't want. On the other hand, if they wanted something that I thought was thoroughly impractical, it tended not to get done because I was their chief executive officer. I mean, I had a veto in effect on what they did, and it's not exactly democratic, but because we dealt in parish pump matters, I think we did know our divisions pretty well. A sign of this was when I was with the Ministry of Public Health, I did a tour of the Agoja province, which was unknown to me, with Sylvester Una, my minister, and it was actually a political tour, but it was necessary that the minister went round and saw bits of the eastern region that he didn't know. And he was going to meet the native authorities, and the native authorities had been stirred up by Zikiwe to resist this government. And in every case, the district officer told me almost exactly what was going to happen at the meeting. He wasn't going to be present at it, but he said, they will hear him and then they will all leave the meeting, or they will refuse to hear him. He knew what was going to happen, and I don't ever recall any election in the eastern region where the district officer didn't know the result before the election. He knew quite well what was going to happen.
To what extent could a man in southeastern Nigeria, where you were in the 1950s, be an individual as opposed to being controlled by the collective?